from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Ohio police murder charge, Iran deal heat, Turkey joins the fight against ISIS, and outrage over a beloved lion's death. In Cincinnati, prosecutor Joe Dieters called the police shooting of motorist Samuel Dubose asinine. White officer Ray Tensing is charged with murder.
When you see this, you will not believe how quickly he pulls his gun and shoots him in the head. It's maybe a second.
Tempers showing over the Iran deal on Capitol Hill. Here's Republican Representative Scott Perry and Secretary of State John Kerry.
We stand for America. You represent America.
Congressman, I don't need any lessons from you about who I represent.
And Zimbabwe wants to try Minnesota dentist Walter Palmer in the death of the lion called Cecil. Outside Palmer's office this week, protesters were ready to see him go.
Extradite.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Margaret Tolliv of Bloomberg Politics, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the death of Samuel Dubose, the quick murder charge, Holocaust talk, and the Iran deal, the death of Cecil? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Also from Washington, Margaret Tolliv is here, back from Africa. She covers the White House and the 2016 presidential race for Bloomberg Politics. Margaret, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here. And hi, Nancy.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Margaret.
Let us go straight to that body cam. These video cameras are showing us all kinds of things we never quite saw before. Here it was when Officer Tensing stopped Samuel Dubose. This was July 19th. He didn't have a front license plate. Here we go.
Well, until I can figure out if you have a license or not, go ahead and take your seatbelt off for me.
I ain't even doing nothing.
Go ahead and take your seatbelt off. Stop! Stop!
A matter of seconds, and Samuel Dubose is dead. Here was the prosecutor in the case, Joe Dieters, with a very quick indictment for Officer Ray Tensing, called the shooting senseless and unwarranted on Wednesday.
I've been doing this for over 30 years. This is the most asinine act I've ever seen a police officer make.
Nancy Cordes, we're all watching, and Margaret, we're all watching globally and on Capitol Hill, big issues going on there, but this is an issue that just continues to rack the nation. It's just one location, one incident after another, each with its own peculiarities, but this time, a matter of seconds, the shots go off, and it falls right back in that category of white officer, dead black person, and the country just... this summer in a state like I don't remember in many years, maybe ever, over what's going on here.
Except in this case, you have law enforcement and prosecutors coming out and saying a point blank that they believe that this is murder. And you played the clip of him saying that he's never seen anything this egregious before. So it seems like you have the authorities in this case trying to kind of get out in front of the story and the obvious flashpoints and say that they believe that what this officer did was wrong, that it was unprovoked, and this is something that has become an issue not just in the cities where incidents like this have taken place, but in Congress and out on the campaign trail. Candidates really being pushed, especially Democratic candidates, to talk about the issues of black women and men who are stopped by the police and what they would do as president to make sure that, as the phrase goes, black lives matter.
Margaret Tolliv, I can't help but ask you, you're just back from Africa. You're with President Obama there. And I just wonder, given the racial complexion of the headlines that have come out on this front in the United States this summer, do Africans ask about it? Do they say, what's going on?
Wow, that's such a fascinating question. I mean, I wish we'd had actually more time to interact with everyday Kenyans or Ethiopians on this trip. The president himself had very little ability to do that. And for many of the Africans there on that trip, their questions have, in a sense, more to do with themselves in Kenya. It's about security. Are they safe against al-Shabaab? It's about resources and whether the U.S. can help them to invest. But one reason why President Obama has been such a popular figure in African countries, in sub-Saharan Africa, is because he is an example of the heights to which you can rise in a meritocracy in the U.S. And this is sort of the other end, you know, of the coin for this. The Guardian has kept a database and has found that the Mr. DuBose was, I think, the 637th person to be killed in the U.S. This year by police. The numbers are disproportionately hurt Black Americans. President Obama's talked about this before. I think he keeps thinking at some point between the police incidents and, you know, the incidents like in Charleston, that there'll be some tipping point on gun use and the discussion about that and, you know, racial progress. And yet it's like Groundhog Day all over again. So it's a terrible story.
Jack Beatty, it may look very clear from the body cam, but you can also feel the officials in Cincinnati very eager to get out in front of this, not to make themselves appear inured to what's going on. Here's the mayor of Cincinnati, John Cranley.
We wanted the right thing to be done, the just thing to be done, the fair thing to be done. We wanted the truth to come out. And when you look at, for example, the videos in New York earlier this year, and you see that no charge was brought, there was a great sense that maybe justice was not done.
Jack, everybody's looking at this body cam in this case, dashboard cam last week, story after story, the country grappling with what appear to be deep truths about racial issues and complexities at the heart of law enforcement and beyond. What are you seeing as this ongoing saga of incidents unfolds?
Well, Tom, the Cincinnati prosecutor said, quote, Officer Tensing should, quote, never have been a policeman. Coast to coast, north and south, rural and urban, it seems the country is just dotted with policemen who should never have been policemen. There are tests used to weed out such bad apples. They need refining. But cops like Tensing may reflect a pool problem, a barrel laden with bad apples. Authoritarian personalities are well known to be drawn to police work. It gives the cover of law to their brutality. It sanctions their racism, a suspicion of wrongdoing. From recruitment to promotion, policing cries out for reform. That'll take years. Meanwhile, minority Americans are going to pay with their lives for the police that polls suggest white Americans remain just fine with.
Is it really fair to fence police off in that special bad apple category, Jack? I mean, is this not part of the fabric of our entire country's population and history?
Oh, yes, but it's just that here is a crux point. Here is a moment where, you know, the people who are serving the public are not serving all the public. And so, yes, they reflect a deeper racism, but I do think that the research points to personalities that get into policing who take it another step further.
Cameras showing us what may have gone on for a long time, but now it's laid out again and again. Gerald in Richmond, Virginia, thank you for calling, Gerald. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's quite hard to express my thoughts because I'm trying to listen in and at the same time put my thoughts together, but I'll do the best I can. It seems that the police officers in these situations that we have videotape of, they have a reason, if it is somewhat dubious, to pull over these motorists, these Black individuals. But as we all know, things just spiral out of control again and again. And it's frightening for one thing, because it can happen to me as a Black male.
Yes, sir.
And the other thing is, it's plain to me that Black individuals, we are viewed in such a prism, through such a prism, that officers seem to feel comfortable using excessive force in dealing with us.
Gerald, do you have confidence? The whole country is talking about it now. Do you feel hope or confidence that out of this conversation and out of all the camera footage that we have seen and I fear we'll see again, that will somehow this will be changed?
It has to change on both sides. Individuals have to understand that when we are accosted by police, that we need to acquiesce to a certain degree to their demands. And we have to have trust and confidence that officers will not approach us from a viewpoint of being a threatening being, that we are a threat to them in these small, minor traffic situations. I mean, it's different if they are approaching a Son of Sam type individual who is known to have hurt and harmed people. But these yes. are simple, minor traffic infractions in a lot of these cases.
Gerald, I really appreciate your call. Margaret, how do you see this playing out on the campaign trail? Nancy Cordes says it's already an issue there. Race has been a wedge issue in the past. How does it play in this context, in this frame-up?
Probably a little bit different in the Democratic primary than it has in the Republican primary. I mean, everybody is going to be obviously outraged by what happened and call for things to change. But you have already seen this Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton dynamic where he has pushed her to the left, pushed her maybe beyond her comfort zone. And to the extent that there's obviously a real effort to turn out the African-American vote and to inspire confidence by both of these Democratic candidates among African-American candidates. And then on sort of on the Republican side of the fence, what you see is a kind of traditional support of law enforcement, but a necessary acknowledgement that this is a matter of concern and not where things should be going.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the Ohio police murder charge, the Iran deal, and Mike Huckabee. Turkey joining the fight against ISIS, outrage over a lion's death in Zimbabwe. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News. Margaret Tala from Bloomberg Politics, just back from Africa with President Obama, and she's been out on the trail. We've got coverage of the campaign trail this week as well. Jack Beatty's here. I want to go to the Iran deal, but we have more callers on Cincinnati. Edith, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm a white 57-year-old woman from Austin, Texas. I'm a native Austinite. I grew up in the South. I have relatives in Jackson, Mississippi. And I can tell you that these atrocities against black people have been going on forever. And the only reason they are in the news now is because they're on film. And before, you know, nobody would believe it.
So now that we see it, and of course the officer Tensing's attorney is interpreting what's on that film differently, but everybody's looking at it and it's pretty shocking. We heard the prosecutor call it asinine. Now that so much of this is on video, how might that change the response, Edith? Will it?
I certainly hope it will, because you know, in the past, I have a godson who's about 30 years old, the product of a black father and a white mother. Mm-hmm. who's a very close friend of mine, mm-hmm. and he's a very large person. He is over 6 feet, and he's just built very big and strong.
Yep.
And he was in so much trouble, and he is the kindest, sweetest, nicest young man and before a young kid that you would ever know. But he would get continually stopped and harassed by police and spent, you know, practically his entire youth on probation or, you know, in a group youth home for such minor infractions as just a tiny little bit of pot or one time it was because he took off from a parking place too fast.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously,
so
that
was
it.
That's getting pretty slight. You've seen it close and with a close family friend, a godson there. I mean, Nancy Cordes, you raised it earlier, how this may play in the political arena in 2016. Margaret Tolliff points out, as you do as well, it's already an issue for Democrats. Who's talking about Black Lives Matter and who's not in a traditional Democrat constituency here? What about more broadly when this becomes a contest across party lines? How do you imagine this one unfolding, Nancy?
Well, I think, you know, demographically, Democrats clearly have the edge among black voters and minorities in general. So I think that you know, the things that Hillary Clinton is saying, even today, to the National Urban League in down in Florida are the kinds of things that are going to resonate in a general election. She is, however, somewhat worried about a candidate, say, like Jeb Bush of Florida, who is also reaching out to at least the Hispanic community and saying that everyone has the right to rise, as his slogan goes. And so she hit him directly, maybe more directly than she ever has before, saying that she doesn't understand how he can use a phrase like that when he's also talking about rolling back Obamacare or cutting Medicare. And she says that this is something that hurts minorities in particular. So clearly she's already trying to lay the groundwork, not just with African Americans, but we've seen a huge amount of outreach among Latinos, because Democrats know that if they want to win the election, they need to hold on to the Obama coalition. It was a lot of Latinos, a lot of African Americans. And so, you know, there's been very, very frank discussion with the Latino community from the very beginning of this campaign.
Jack Beatty, what about disillusion with the Democratic Party that has already emerged in some quarters with this? We saw at the Netroots convention where hecklers got up on the stage. Hillary Clinton avoided that entirely. They wanted more Black Lives Matter talk. And you heard candidates trying to pass, kind of have it both ways. Right now, there are African-American voters who don't want to hear it turned into All Lives Matter. They want something more focused and more specific than that. Will they get it? How do you see it rolling out, Jack?
Well, they need to hear it, and perhaps one thing they could hear is the candidates talking about best practices, and the Cincinnati police force shows that, ironically enough. 15 years ago, there was a police killing of a Black citizen. It led to days of riot, and in reform, the whole police force became much more community oriented. They have had a 60% reduction in Cincinnati in officer caused incidents. What's Cincinnati doing right, and what can the rest of the country learn from it? I'd like to hear the Democrats address that.
Let's go to Pat in New Haven, Connecticut. Pat, thank you for calling. You are on the air.
Hi. Well, thank you very much for accepting my call. Actually, I just wanted to bring it my perspective to light as a you know, Black man growing up in this environment, as you know, as a young man, even up to this point as an older man, and having to go through the scrutinization of white officers, and I find it even amongst best Hispanic officers and Blacks. So there's not really a, I mean, I'm not saying it's not a definite color issue, because there clearly is. I'm walking in my neighborhood as a young man, I pulled over several times by white officers flashing lights at me, provoking something. But I lived there. I lived in the neighborhood, going into my steps. And recently, being pulled over for silly traffic issues, making turns, and you know, when they pulled me over, banging on the car intentionally to provoke some type of response from me, and it was noted by friends. At the time, I didn't have the wherewithal to record it, but, you know, you're pulled over, it's the first thing you're taught is to respect the law, but they have no respect and regard for you. But I feel what I wanted to kind of address is the fact that the training has to change. You know, we are such a hypocritical country that we're spending millions of dollars to send our troops over, in Black, white, and Spanish troops over to other countries to fight racism and not racism per se, but terrorism, rather. But the terrorism still exists in this country since, you know, 200 years ago. And it's happening to people who live in communities who want to live a normal life, who have the freedom and the rights that are being taken away from them. Now, these officers are being trained very militantly, and they're treating people in these communities that way. If you walk in, if you live in a white neighborhood, they won't tell you, you know, they won't treat you as if you belong. And if a white person looks out their window, see you walking, they call the police comes and immediately assume that you're a criminal, and they treat you that way. And I've watched it happen, it's happened to me, and it's happened to so many people. So the training has to stop. We have to look at how they're training law enforcement today. You know, we want to respect the police officers, but they've got to learn to respect the community and recognize that just because you're Black and just because you're Spanish, and not to bring Donald Trump in, because I don't want to, certainly don't want to blow his balloon up. He's such a hypocrite. He's over here bringing the same type of mentality that most white, wealthy constituents in America has, and that's what fuels these law enforcement officers. I mean, these Leos don't need to be, you know, fueled with this kind of violence. They're already under post-traumatic stress. Okay, of their job. I understand that. I've got friends who are police officers, and I respect them entirely, Black, white, and Spanish. But Donald Trump is supporting that kind of mentality, and he's telling people things like Hispanics are rapists, Mexicans are rapists and murderers, and that's what we need to protect the border from. Well, they treat Black people the same way.
Pat, we've got it. I want to take it to Margaret Tolliver. I appreciate your call. Margaret, do we get to a fresh, deeper cultural rethink on how we understand race in this country? And does that play out in the campaign?
I do. I mean, I think it's happening right now. And don't forget, I know it's been a busy summer, but don't forget about the case of Sandra Bland, which also just happened. Black woman pulled over on a traffic stop, hangs herself in jail. I mean, as a 43-year-old white woman, what if I got pulled over for a traffic infraction? I worry about getting a ticket. I don't worry about my life ending. This is a real problem.
That is a conversation that's going to go on. It's going deeper. We see it, and the cameras are driving it. I want to turn to the Iran deal. We heard John Kerry having even who he works for questioned there on Capitol Hill, him shooting back that he didn't need to be lectured on that front. The language got pretty tough with Mike Huckabee. This was last Sunday with Breitbart News. Former Arkansas governor, presidential contender Mike Huckabee maxed up the rhetoric on the Iran deal, drawing a connection between the deal and the Holocaust.
This president's foreign policy is the most speckless in American history. He's so naive, he would trust the Iranians, and he would take the Israelis and basically march them to the door of the oven.
Take the Israelis and basically march them to the door of the oven, and there it is, the Holocaust in the middle of the Iran deal debate. Ted Cruz, Texas senator, presidential contender himself, talking again in this week about Obama with the money that would come to Iran on the other side of a deal, money now being held by banks, saying it would make the president of the United States the world's leading financier of terrorism.
Indeed, if this deal is consummated, it will make the Obama administration the world's leading financier of radical Islamic terrorism.
Nancy Cordes, you've been watching for a long time now. You're watching the debate on the Hill about this. Now it's on the campaign trail as well. What do you make of this kind of very high rhetoric? World's leading financier of radical Islamic terrorism, the president of the United States. The president of the United States marching Israelis to the door of the oven.
Well, I think there's a couple things going on here. First of all, I think that they truly believe that, or at least they say they believe it, because they were both given an opportunity to walk back some of that rhetoric. And not only did they not walk it back, but in Huckabee's case, he went further in several additional interviews. I think the other thing that's going on is that they see that there is a segment of the population that really likes what Donald Trump is selling, that the more incendiary the things he says are, the more support he seems to get in the polls. And the people who are supporting him are people who used to really love what Ted Cruz was saying and what Mike Huckabee was saying, and he's sort of stealing their thunder. And I think that this was a chance for them to try and steal that thunder back in advance of the GOP debates next week.
Margaret, is this now a contest over who can be most thunderous?
Yeah, I mean, I think Nancy's exactly right. You got to look at the sort of some of the timing, time stamps for this. You've got this Fox debate on August 6th. You have to be in the top 10. The top 10 gets judged by polling. Polling gets judged by a certain span of time where people are in the news. And, you know, everybody wants to make the cut for that debate. If you're going to say something controversial, hey, now's a good time to do it. But Huckabee is a really interesting case because, of course, it was in 2008, a couple presidential swings back, he was in favor of engagement with Iran. He was saying he thought he could live with containment as long as they didn't get, you know, a nuclear weapon. And I think President Obama, it's hard to tell sometimes when he's really mad about something or when he's kind of playing mad for effect. But in Africa, where he really wanted to be talking about U.S.-Africa policy, he was very eager to take the ball and run with it when given a chance on this. I think he's really, between these presidential candidates and kind of the Israel lobbying campaign, he's really furious about the turn of events.
There's a lot going on here, a lot of dynamics intersecting. But Jack, maybe we've got a new structural prod toward this sort of way up there rhetoric. If you've got to be in the top 10, you've got the debates looming. Are we in a situation where people will say anything to try and flame themselves onto the stage?
It's an outrage race, isn't it? You know, and against fierce competition from Huckabee and Cruz, to me, the most chilling statement I heard this week was from Dan Kurzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and admittedly a supporter of the Iran nuke deal.
But he was named by George W. Bush or H.W. Bush as ambassador?
I believe so. He said that he'd heard Huckabee's Holocaust rhetoric before in Israel, in the weeks before Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was talking peace with Yasser Arafat, was assassinated by a right-wing fanatic. You know, it isn't news that conservatives distrust diplomacy and have attacked arms deals and have used, Neville Chamberlain language to attack Ronald Reagan even for reaching an arms deal with the Soviet Union. But this time, with this president, it feels different and even dangerous, playing with fire. You know, one really longs for a rival to confront Cruz or Huckabee on the debate stage. Perhaps Rick Perry or Jeb Bush could echo what Joe Welch, his remonstrance to Joe McCarthy during the Army McCarthy hearings. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
Aaron in Atlanta, Georgia. Aaron, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I think all the responses to Mike Huckabee's statement are a little out of proportion. If Iran did obtain a nuclear weapon, and they've stated over the years that they want to annihilate Israel, so if they obtained a nuclear weapon and launched it, that would be comparable to the Holocaust.
So this is the right kind of rhetoric or reasonable rhetoric to your ear, Aaron?
I believe so. Some of the other rhetoric saying that it's almost some of the other politicians are almost saying that they are lessening the effect of Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon, saying that it's not comparable.
I don't know if it's lessening the effect of them getting it or saying they're less likely to get it under the deal, but I take your point. You hear it and say, all right, there's been all kinds of reactions here. We've got a little tape here from Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador to the U.S. He called Huckabee's rhetoric inappropriate. This is Israel's ambassador to the United States talking with USA Today on Tuesday.
I would never use those words, and I don't think it's appropriate. Look, we have a very serious disagreement with the administration on a very serious issue. But what I don't doubt is the sincerity of the president or his team when they say they believe this deal makes not only America safer, makes Israel safer.
Lou in Dubuque, Iowa. What do you think, Lou? Aaron in Atlanta says not unreasonable for Huckabee to go there. Ted Cruz went to funding terrorism. How do you see it, Lou?
Well, Ted Cruz should be brought up on treasonous charges, number one. Huckabee's running for president as well. There's one thing that they won't tell you about the deal, and that is, and almost all of the presidential candidates, there's some out there that maybe Rand Paul and some sensible ones on the right, but the first thing that one of somebody like Ted Cruz or Scott Walker or any some of the other ones, the first thing they do when they get into office is going to go to war with Iran. And when they do go to war with Iran, it's not going to be like Iraq or anything that they've ever witnessed before. This is a negotiation that was done with world powers, about six or seven of them, with very, very smart people. It wasn't a perfect deal, but it gets the job done as far as the number one priority, which was to stop Iran from a nuclear weapon. Now, what they also won't tell you is that if there is no deal right now, they're going to have a nuclear weapon within about 3 to 6 months is what some of the experts say.
Lou, we've got it. Our time is short before the break. Margaret Tolliff, maybe this hot talk can get people onto that stage in the August 6th Republican debate. How does it play out over time in this campaign? And this split now over the Iran deal and U.S.-Israel relations.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Both sides are playing the long game. Obama thinks if he can slow things down for 10 or 15 years, it may change Iran. The Republicans are saying if you wait that long, they'll wait you out and go for the nuke then.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, debris found on an island off Africa is very likely to be from the missing Malaysia Airline Flight 370, investigators say. Here's NBC's Bill Neely on the island of Reunion.
They are examining the damage and the encrusted shells on the piece that was dragged from the waves by a beach cleanup team.
The long-standing ban on gay Boy Scout leaders officially dropped this week. Eric Hay is a member of Scouts for Equality.
It's nice knowing that whenever I do want to get back in scouts, that I'm going to be able to do so as an adult leader.
And Boston is out of the running for the 2024 Olympics, but China will do it again and sooner.
The host city of the Olympic Winter Games 2022. Beijing.
We're looking at a week in the news. The Ohio police murder charge, the Iran deal, and Huckabee, Cruz, Turkey joining the fight against ISIS, outrage over a lion's death in Zimbabwe, an American dentist, the killer, the hunter, if you put it that way. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News, Margaret Tala from Bloomberg News, Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. Just a little bit here from the president. He was in Africa this week. Here he was talking with the Kenyan people, describing himself not just as an African-American, but to the crowd's delight there, as a Kenyan-American.
I am proud to be the first American president to come to Kenya. And of course, I'm the first Kenyan American to be president of the United States.
The local shout out, always a crowd pleaser. Margaret Tollef, what's the takeaway from the president's, several day trip to Africa? Did he manage to persuade people that the U.S. is the partner there, not China?
Well, he's sort of chipping away at that one. I mean, I saw a lot of what he was doing as legacy building, really, talking about how he intends to become not only as involved, but more involved after he's finished with the presidency. I expect to see him involved, particularly in the youth activities that he's trying to build youth leadership in Africa, and some really strong sort of scolding for many African leaders on this trip beyond the two countries where he was visiting, saying, look, there are things that you can do to help spur business investment, such as human rights, anti-corruption activities, that sort of stuff. But he's trying to make the case that the U.S. is a more trustworthy partner than China without sort of coming right out and saying it. And it's, you know, the White House acknowledges themselves that these are pragmatic decisions that African leaders are going to make, and that if they don't engage with these countries, whether it's Ethiopia, that the Ethiopians, the Kenyans, anyone, any African countries have other willing partners to engage with.
Now, but China's trade with Africa soaring over $200 billion. The U.S. was sinking down to like $70 billion or something, headed in opposite directions there. And of course, influence often follows. Nancy Cordes, Ted Cruz out swinging this week. Last week, he called Mitch McConnell a lot. The Senate leader, he took the Senate floor on a Sunday session, unusual session, to continue to criticize McConnell. Here's the flavor of that, Ted Cruz.
The majority leader in front of every Republican senator made that promise, looking me in the eyes, namely that there was no deal on the Export-Import Bank, that its proponents could offer it in the regular order, and there would be no special preferences whatsoever. We saw on Friday that promise was false.
Nancy Cordes, where are we on infrastructure spending at this point? It's been confusing to follow that the House and Senate as they came toward their August recess. What about the Export-Import Bank? I know it's a hot issue in the GOP.
Right. And add to that Planned Parenthood, which they now say that they want to try to defund first next week before they even move towards the infrastructure spending. It's unlikely that they're going to be successful in defunding Planned Parenthood because they need 60 votes to do that. And there are only 54 of them. And you already have a couple of Republicans like Susan Collins of Maine saying that they're not going to go along with that. But it's interesting that clip that you played of Ted Cruz. You know, to a lot of people, that may not sound all that terrible, what he said. But on the Senate floor, those are fighting words. You just don't call another senator a liar, especially not the leader of your own party. And Republicans and Democrats alike were pretty shocked by that. It's a real breach of protocol and a real escalation in some of the intensity and back and forth that we've seen happening more and more on the Senate floor in the past couple of years. And you had this pretty extraordinary sight of longtime Republicans coming out onto the Senate floor after that to sort of smack Cruz down and say, look, what you're saying might work well on the campaign trail, but that's not how we conduct ourselves in the Senate. And don't forget, we've got four or five senators running for president. So, you could see more heated remarks this year as they all try to set themselves apart and try to show that they're not just willing to go up against the Democrats, but they're willing to hold their own party's feet to the fire on issues that some in the grassroots feel have been neglected.
Planned Parenthood under fire after this group came in, kind of undercover, made videos of them talking about fetal tissue that come out of abortion clinics, go into research on HIV and cancer research and more. It is hard to listen to the talk of defunding. Does it have real traction, Nancy? What's the head count look like? Could that happen?
I don't think it could. It's certainly a big issue for Republicans, both in Congress and on the campaign trail. We've heard a lot about it, but the bottom line is that they don't have the votes in the Senate to do it. I had a chance to ask Hillary Clinton about the issue yesterday, and she said that this is another attempt by Republicans to roll back women's health. But she herself has said that she finds the images and the videos disturbing, and that perhaps there needs to be a nationwide review of how fetal tissue is procured, not just from Planned Parenthood, but from all medical facilities that perform abortions and set aside some of these organs or fetal tissue for medical research.
Clearly, this group that went after Planned Parenthood is very aware that this is deeply unsettling kind of conversation to hear, no matter what you think of the research. And it is. Kathleen in Austin, Texas. You're on the air, Kathleen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a retired United Methodist pastor and a strong supporter of Planned Parenthood. I fear the Republican candidates for president have hopped on this issue. The fetal tissue donation is another issue in itself and a controversial one, I know, but I fear they've hopped on this issue simply as a way of chipping away at the support for Planned Parenthood, and they are not telling the truth that most of what Planned Parenthood does is provide health care and contraception for women who could not afford it otherwise. And they represent a party which has not been particularly supportive of taking care of those women and of the children who are born into families where there are already more children than can be supported.
Well, I mean, you say hopped on, Kathleen, but many of these opponents of Planned Parenthood are also longtime opponents of abortion, and Planned Parenthood does have a role there in addition to the role that you described, which is very substantial. Hopped on, this has been a long campaign.
It is a long campaign, but they grab every time to get onto it. As a supporter, a longtime supporter of Planned Parenthood, and as I said, retired, I sent a donation to Planned Parenthood as soon as the story broke because I wanted to encourage our Texas regional chapter and the good work that they're doing.
Kathleen, I appreciate your call. Margaret Tolliff, how do you see this one playing out on the campaign trail?
I mean, it will be really interesting to see how it plays out because there has been concern within the Republican Party that focusing too much on issues like abortion or gay rights could actually backfire in terms of a general. And we're still clearly in the throes of primary season. See earlier conversation on Iran debate. But there's, I think, going to be a real calibration. And it probably helps the Republicans from a sort of politically protective standpoint if there is a ceiling, as Nancy suggests, to how far this can go in Congress, because it's one thing to debate the issues when there isn't a real action that's going to be attached to it. It's another thing if the debate, prompts votes and votes. You're getting real when you get to votes. And so I think it'll certainly be a topic for discussion, but the focus this summer seems to be much more, to me, on Iran and foreign policy than it is on this.
Nancy, we heard that assault on Mitch McConnell by Ted Cruz, a more tangible kind of challenge to the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, this week. You had conservative Congressman Mark Meadows out of North Carolina actually filing a motion to remove John Boehner as Speaker of the House. We got a little tape here of Boehner brushing that challenge aside at a Wednesday press conference. Said the work of a lone congressman.
You got a member here and a member there who are off the reservation. No big deal. This is one member. All right? I've got broad support amongst my colleagues. And frankly, it isn't even deserving of a vote.
Nancy Cordes, no big deal. Broad support. Is John Boehner right?
he is right in this case, and I doubt he lost that much sleep over this challenge to his speakership. This is a member who's part of a small cadre who have challenged Speaker Boehner before, who don't think that he's responsive enough to the concerns of his right flank. By and large, members, A, do support Speaker Boehner, B, realize that he has an incredibly difficult job trying to triangulate between what his more moderate members want, what some of his most conservative members want, and what he knows can pass. And third, nobody else wants to have to do that job because it is so difficult. And in order to do what this congressman wanted to do, he would have had to get 218 signatures to move it forward. And even some of his closest allies said that they were completely shocked when he did this and that they thought that he had gone too far this time. So it came up and died a quick death right away.
Nancy, you were with Donald Trump this week, I believe. The polls, the latest ones out, show him with a very commanding lead. Now, I know it's early. Nevertheless, fully 20% of Republican-leaning voters say they'd vote for Trump if the primary were held today. Behind that, you've got Scott Walker at 13% in this Quinnipiac poll, Jeb Bush at 10%, and then right on down into small numbers. It was only a few weeks ago where people were scoffing at the whole Trump candidacy, and here he is with sort of double what Jeb Bush has now. What do you make of it, Nancy?
Well, I think when you're trying to figure out who the people are who are supporting Trump, you have to think back to the rise of the Tea Party in 2010. And it arose because people were deeply frustrated with the Obama administration, with Obamacare. They thought that the president was going too far. There was a lot of economic insecurity, and they were very worried. Imagine how much more frustrated those people are now, 5 years later. They're angry about his unilateral moves on immigration. They're worried about this Iran deal. And here comes a guy, Donald Trump, who is saying everything that they feel, and it feels great. And I've talked to a number of his supporters at one event, for example, in South Carolina, and they said, you know, I don't know if he'd be a great president, but I love what he's saying. And I think he's, you know, he's sticking it to the president. He's even sticking it to our own party on issues that we don't feel like they're going far enough on. And, you know, I had one woman say to me, you know, it's gotten to the point where you can't even go to the Walmart or go to the beach without worrying about being kidnapped by an illegal immigrant. So there are people who really feel this way. That came as news to me. But, you know, there are people, and clearly a lot of them, who have grave concerns about illegal immigration, who have grave concerns about this president. And Donald Trump is speaking loudly and clearly for them.
I mean, Margaret, yes, please.
No, I was going to say, ironically, I mean, he's been very good. By all accounts, he's been very good for Jeb Bush, too, at the same time.
It's
not like there's no evidence that the people who are flocking to Donald Trump were in Jeb Bush's camp and have now said, oh, my God, what was I thinking? Never mind, I'm a Donald Trump fan. You know, these are people who were never going to back Jeb Bush anyway. And what you seem to be seeing is sort of a clearing of the space in the middle where Cruz, you know, Rand Paul, even Marco Rubio are having trouble finding, you know, daylight in these last couple of weeks. And the two kind of ends of the spectrum have been Trump and Bush. And so you're going into this debate next week on Fox, and you're seeing a lot of the kind of establishment Republicans, business Republicans reacting against Trump, making Jeb Bush look a little bit more attractive. So, I think this has been particularly bad for Cruz, for Rand Paul, for Walker and Bush. They may be concerned about what impact Trump will have on the branding of the party heading in to a general. But it's not clear that he's actually bad for them in the primary.
Trump definitely making a big impression. Anderson in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Anderson, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My point is that the U.S. and Turkey should support the PKK and YPG and Rojava for their usefulness as an ally against ISIS.
You're talking about Kurds, that Turkey has now turned some of its firepower on, even as it's turning its firepower, or says it will, against ISIS.
Yeah, they should totally not do that, and they should support the Kurds. And also, any left-winger should support the Kurds as well because of their feminist anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian stance.
Anderson, we've got it. Jack Beatty, this has become very interesting this week with Turkey getting into the campaign against ISIS. Yeah. They want an ISIS-free zone along their border. They want U.S. help to get that. But their first target, Kurds within their own borders, with the longstanding conflict there, an election coming up, and Erdogan going after the Kurds inside. Kurds who have, in toto, been the biggest block to ISIS and al-Qaeda in the region.
You know, it took the BBC 20 minutes to excavate the Machiavellian depths of this decision to join the anti-ISIS coalition. The bottom line, ISIS is guerrilla dust. Ankara's real game, as our caller said, is to attack the Iraqi Kurdish guerrillas who are allied with the Syrian Kurdish rebels fighting ISIS. Its subsidiary aim is domestic political, as you say, Tom, ahead of snap elections to play the nationalist card against the Kurd-friendly parties in Turkey, who in elections just last month cost the Erdogan government its parliamentary majority. The Americans, of course, are blinded by the guerrilla dust. They just think it's great we've got these bases.
Watch all that. U.S. Back on the bases in Turkey. Turkey in gear on maybe ISIS, but certainly Kurds within its own border. Here's a listener looking at Cincinnati, thinking about Harper Lee, thinking about her new book, quoting the Bible. Go set a watchman and let him declare what he sees. Isaiah 21. And says, go set a dash cam and let it upload what it records. We are in new racial territory. Nancy, Margaret, Jack, thanks to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.